Hello, I'm Katie.
And I'm Leslie.
And we're all booked.
Welcome back to another episode of Sterling Municipal Library's podcast, where we talk to you about the books we'd like to recommend.
And I am very excited to introduce a new guest to our podcast. Her name is Donna, and she is bringing a whole bunch of books about brains today, correct?
That's right, Leslie. Thanks so much. I'm so happy to be here. I believe that books build better brains. And so to strengthen that brain muscle, the books I'm going to share with you today all have to do something with the brain. And the first one I'm going to talk about is, the title is Moonwalking with Einstein by Joshua Foer. And the subtitle is The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. And one of the things that I struggle with is trying to remember all of the things I have to keep up with: family, work, social, personal obligations. And the point he makes in this book is that we offload a great deal of our memories. I have sticky notes everywhere. I have lists. My lists have lists. That's just the way our lives are. And what he tells about is how he went from just ordinary guy to being the champion of the final. He found himself in the finals of the U.S. Memory Championship.
Oh, wow.
Right.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah. So how did he get from average Joe to that?
Well, that's the interesting part of this book, is that he draws on cutting-edge research and a surprising cultural history of memory and venerable tricks of the mentalist trade to transform our understanding of human remembering. Under the tutelage of top mental athletes, Foer learns ancient techniques once employed by Cicero to memorize his speeches and by medieval scholars to memorize entire books. Using methods that have been largely forgotten, he discovers that we can all dramatically improve our memories. Immersing himself obsessively in a quirky subculture of competitive memorizers, Foer learns to apply techniques that call on imagination as much as determination, showing that memorization can be anything but rote. From the PAO system, which converts numbers into lurid images, to the memory palace, in which memories are stored in the rooms of imaginary structures, Foer's experience shows that the memory championships are less a test of memory than of perseverance and creativity.
So for these championships, you mentioned like speeches, and how do they determine like who wins?
You know, I don't remember that there was a great deal about how they determined who who won, but it was just such an interesting book to learn different tips and tricks that we can, you know, the brain is a muscle that, you know, if you, you know, the more you use it, the stronger it gets. And so using some of his techniques were just really fascinating to me. And while I won't say that I have used a lot of them, the Memory Palace one was one that I tried to use for a while and found that it really was very helpful.
Really?
Right. That is one that I've only heard of via Sherlock.
Sherlock, of course. Yes, Sherlock.
So can you tell us a little bit about how that works, that specifically, the memory palace?
I think that was where you took certain memories and tried to put them in a specific room in,
okay,
as you built the palace, and use trying to remember what you're trying to remember, put it in a specific place.
Okay.
But anyway, fascinating read. Highly recommend it. The title, it always gets people to say, gee, I wonder what that book's about.
Yeah.
So Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything by Joshua Foer.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, one of my favorite podcasts is called Memory Palace, and it's
really
basically a guy will look for all of these really obscure stories that are kind of lost from history. You know, it's, you know, athletes who kind of like fell by the wayside once they were no longer boxing or stuff like that. And he would actually focus on what happened after their moment in the limelight.
Hmm. Oh, well, now that would be fascinating. I would enjoy reading that.
It's a really good series.
Yeah, great. Well, the second book I brought was, the title is Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain, and it's written by David Eagleman. And I had the pleasure of hearing him speak at Christ Church Cathedral in Houston a number of years ago. And the book is, he is the director of the Institute of Neuroscience and Law at Baylor College of Medicine.
Oh, wow.
And he directs the lab on sensory perception there at Christ Church Cathedral. Christ Church Cathedral has provides services to the homeless there in Houston at the Beacon first floor. And the interesting thing, the premise that he asks is how much of, because the brain controls every single thing we think, do, say, and feel from inside a control room that it cannot see or smell or feel or get any type of sensory perception except what comes from outside its vault. How much of what we do is choice, free will, or part of the brain and what it's doing and the kinds of things that have happened to it? And so he asked the question about the neural basis of morality and decision making.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some really interesting, fascinating stories that he presents by different very famous people. The first one, I believe, is about the shooter at the University of Texas many years ago. And as they went after when they performed the autopsy, they found out that he had this huge, massive tumor on his brain. And as they went through some of his writings, found that, you know, that he recognized he had this tumor in his brain and what it was causing him to do and feel and think. And so he asked, David Engelman asked the question about culpability. Our legal system rests on, one, that we are practical reasoners, that we're free to choose how we act, and two, that all brains have equal capacity, which may or may not be actually true.
Right.
So the USA is the number one country for people being incarcerated. And of those people who are incarcerated, the largest part of that population have serious mental illness. He goes on to ask the question that maybe we should not ask about culpability, but move forward asking and making our utilitarian system or sentence based on the probability of recidivism.
Mm-hmm.
And so our social policy should be run as rigorously as any science experiment. So how likely is this person to commit another crime? And what we find statistically is that people who suffer with mental illness are far more likely to be victims of crime than to commit crime. But unfortunately, our society presents that picture of, you know, if someone has a mental illness, that they are dangerous to our society or to themselves, which is so totally not true. And David Engelman, he has a new book out, and I saw that you'll have his latest copy of his book, but I wasn't able to read it, but I'm excited to read his new book because he's an excellent writer, and his subject matter is just fascinating.
Now, he sounds incredibly intellectual. Is he approachable still with his writing style?
Very much so.
Okay.
It's not dry. He's very much a storyteller, so he's very much a readable. He also had a series, and I don't remember if it was on Discovery Channel or if it was on PBS or whatever, but it was about the life of the brain.
Oh,
and
wow.
They had different segments. I think there were like 8 sessions. And so he drew from his work, not only with this book, Incognito, because he's written a number of books about the brain. So another great one, great author. Another one I had the pleasure to hear speak is Dr. Jill Taylor Bolte. She is a neuroscientist at Harvard University, and she spoke at the American Library Association conference in Chicago a number of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to that conference strictly to hear her speak because is amazing. So the book I brought today to share with you is called My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey. And what happened to Dr. Bolte when she was 35 years old, she's getting ready to go to work one morning, and she's not feeling exactly right. And she's like, wow, what is going on? And she finds that she can't function the way she should. And she's thinking, I think something's wrong. What's happening? I think I'm having a stroke. Because as a neuroscientist, she knew the steps and what was happening, you know, with the stroke. And so when she finally realizes that, oh, I need to get help. And then she goes through the whole process of, I need to get help. I need to pick up the phone. And then she's finding that she's sending these messages to her body, and her body is not responding.
Oh, my goodness.
So, bottom line, she has the stroke, winds up in the hospital, and she ends up not being able to speak, not being able to walk, talk, anything, for almost 8 years.
Oh, wow.
Yes. But the remarkable story is the recovery. Her mother, she credits her recovery to her mother. Her mother came and stayed with her and cared with her there at the hospital and did a number of things to help her, to remind her of who she was.
Mm-hmm.
And her TED Talk on resilience is absolutely amazing. It will blow you away when you see her and see the pictures of her in the hospital after her stroke and year after year after year. And then you hear this woman speak. It's just absolutely amazing.
How old was she when she had the stroke?
She was in her mid-30s. I can't remember if it was 34 or 36.
Mm-hmm. That's awfully young.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very young. So that was the thing that was just so unusual about her situation.
She said she was already a neuroscientist before
Yes, she was. Okay. Yes. And she still, you know, practices now. She's back, you know, teaching at Harvard and practicing there after her remarkable recovery.
So it's called My Stroke of Insight. Is most of it about her recovery or about maybe the processes of the brain? Or
she brings a little bit of the neuroscience into her story because it plays such a pivotal role in her story, but it's mainly about her recovery.
Okay.
But the thing that I love about it and was really helpful for me personally was at the end she offers 40 things I needed most. And what did she need when she was, you know, uncommunicative, when she was unable to walk, those kinds of things. And number one, she says, I am not stupid. I am wounded. Please respect me.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, my, that is powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one, come close, speak slowly, and enunciate clearly. So I just found that her 40 steps were things that, you know, you think, well, yeah, gee, I know that. But until somebody speaks it and writes it out, you're thinking, that was an important reminder for me.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we've used as a family lately, our number 39 says, show me old video footage of me doing things to remind me how I spoke, walked, gestured, because that reminded her. And so that her mother had all these pictures all over her room of you know, who she was as a child, as a young woman, as an early doctor, and it helped her reach out and gather those parts of the brain again.
Was her mother just doing this intuitively, or did she understand some science behind it?
You know, I don't remember. I think her mother was probably just doing what mothers do.
Yeah.
But she, I mean, that's just an amazing thing. That her mother just, I mean, there's one picture that it's just so heartbreaking. And, you know, there's Jill Taylor Bolte, and she has, you know, her head shaved, and she's got this huge scar on her head, and she's just kind of curled up in a fetal position, and there's her mother, you know, curled around her. And I just thought, ah, the power of love, you know, the power of love to do so many cool things to help us recover and give us hope when we just really don't have it. Anyway, My Stroke of Insight, which is, like I said, you can see her talks on YouTube. And if you want to be inspired in the morning, get up and watch one of them, because she will get you fired up and ready for your day.
I can even link her TED Talk in our podcast description.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that would be great. Oh, I'd love that. So, I've been kind of focusing on nonfiction books there. And this is a fairly new book that I can't remember who recommended it to me. But the title is called Anxious People, a novel. And it's written by Frederick Backman. I guess that's how you pronounce his name. Anyway, he's the best-selling author of A Man Called Ove.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. I thought that font looked familiar on the
on the cover. Yes, definitely. And during this 2020, you know, there's a lot of anxious people around, and rightfully so. And so I thought, well, I wonder if this was the right book for me to be reading now.
Right.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about the book is it starts off and just kind of sets the premise. And the interesting thing for me was how sometimes we as people sometimes can make things not what they seem to be, or looking at situations, not having all the information. And so then we make choices that just make things go a little
sideways.
Worse,
yeah.
Or go sideways or whatever. But it also, the book shows about how our connection to each other is very powerful. So if you don't mind, I'm going to read just the first couple of paragraphs, kind of sets the stage, because to me, it just gives such a flavor of the author and his writing. And so it starts off, a bank robbery, a hostage drama, a stairwell full of police officers on their way to storm an apartment. It was easy to get to this point, much easier than you might think. All it took was one single really bad idea. This story is about a lot of things, but mostly about idiots. So it needs saying from the outset that it was always very easy to declare that other people are idiots, but only if you forgot how idiotically difficult being human is, especially if you have other people you're trying to be reasonably good human for, because there's such an unbelievable amount that we are all supposed to be able to cope with these days. You're supposed to have a job and somewhere to live. And a family, and you're supposed to pay taxes, and have some clean underwear. And remember the password to your Wi-Fi. Some of us never manage to get the chaos under control, so our lives simply carry on. The world spinning through space at 2 million miles an hour while we bounce about on its surface like so many lost socks.
So I think, and I never read it, but from what I heard or know about A Man Called Uwe, it's kind of ultimately kind of uplifting, positive, right?
Very much so. But it starts off similar to this book.
Interesting.
There's a crisis and things keep going. The people, the players in the story, things go sideways, and you're like, why did that person do that? And then the next chapter you think, oh, well, okay. But yet what this book shows is that it's humorous, it's compassionate and wise. Anxious People is an ingeniously constructed story about the enduring power of friendship, forgiveness, and hope, the things that save us even in the most anxious of times. And we're all facing our anxious times. So Anxious People
is not so anxiety-inducing after all.
Maybe a little towards the beginning.
Yes.
No, but it really, I'm only halfway finished with it, but it's just delightful. And the characters are ones that you can so totally relate to. And the interesting thing is some of the police action, you can think, wow, you know, we're seeing some of this in, you know, reading about this in the newspaper and how things can go terribly wrong when people don't quite understand what the situation truly is and that the other people in the room are carrying a heavy load.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I've talked a little bit about mental illness, and we are so fortunate in the Houston area that we have the NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. So a NAMI of GreaterHouston.org sends out a newsletter, and some of the interesting, just I'm fascinated by numbers and just see how it kind of relates to our world.
Mm-hmm.
And what they, in the last newsletter they got, it said 60% of counties in the United States don't have a mental health professional.
I'm not surprised. I mean, just Texas has a vast amount of counties.
Yeah. Texas is one of the worst of the 50 states. They used to be at 49, I think. Now, thanks to Louisiana or Mississippi, they're up to 48. But still nothing to,
it's usually nothing to be proud of.
Only 43% of adults with mental illness ever receive treatment. 20% of people experiencing homelessness have a serious mental illness. 70% of youth in the juvenile justice system have at least one mental health condition. And 1 trillion. Depression and anxiety disorders cost the global economy $1 trillion each year in lost productivity. So it's a huge problem that if we spend more resources and get people help and treatment, can certainly benefit all of our communities. And this morning at 1 a.m. when I woke up about thinking about this podcast, I checked Facebook and NAMI Greater Houston just posted that they're having their family-to-family class starting on Saturdays, starting on November the 14th. So I guess that's
this Saturday.
This Saturday. Each class is 8 weeks long, and they're all going to be in a virtual setting. So if anyone's interested, they can go to NAMIGreaterHouston.org and find out more information about where those classes are going to
be held. I'll also link that in our podcast description.
That would be great. So not to leave the children out, I picked up just a couple of children books. This one is called The Brain is Kind of a Big Deal, and it's by Nick Selleck, and it's a Scholastic print published. And the interesting thing is it gives a lot of great factual information about the brain, but as you can, well, you can see the pictures, but it's a very kid-friendly format. It's very straightforward and just talks about how, you know, you can see it's a picture of the band, and the brain is the lead guitarist of the band.
I do appreciate that the heart is the drummer.
The heart is the drummer.
That's cute.
That's great.
Oh, lungs are backup vocals.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm just getting so much joy from what they've decided all of these organs do in this band.
Exactly. And that was the thing. You know, at this time, I know that I've struggled with, you know, where can I find the joy? Because there's been a lot to be afraid of and to be sad about. And And one of the things, besides, like you said, the organs of the members of the band here, is Dr. Brené Brown. I have read her books for many years, but she has this new podcast called Unlocking Us. And the joy that I get listening to her and finding out ways to find joy. I have really very much enjoyed her podcast. And so when you all invited me to be on this podcast, I thought, oh, my goodness, I'm just gotten into podcasts. I'd not really listened to any before, but I thought, well, she makes me feel so happy when I listen to her. So maybe, you know, that this is a great thing. So
yeah, no, and this is such a pertinent topic for 2020 especially, but in general, I feel like it doesn't get talked about enough, especially if you're talking about mental illness and resources that are available.
Right.
It's enough of a stigmatized topic that people do have trouble really talking about it or approaching it. And
right.
It's a shame.
It is. It is a shame. And one of the things I am so excited about that's coming to Baytown, just last week, Lee College partnered with the Meadows Foundation in their OK to Say campaign. And the OK to Say campaign was developed to support college students and letting them know that it's OK to talk about mental illness. It's OK to check in with your friends and to see, how are you doing today?
Mm-hmm.
And, OK, if you're not feeling so well today, I'll stay with you until you can get help or we can find someone who can help. And so excited about the resources that they will be bringing here to the Baytown area. And they have three different components of it. The OK to Say is designed for college students. But then they have other components that one is called the Kids Page or the Kids Zone, and that's designed for your elementary age students. And then there's also a middle school, high school component. So the resources are electronic, some great things. And so I'm excited that we're going to be able to push that out.
Yeah.
Hopefully before the end of the year, because people need to have the resources to help with. I'm hoping that we can get that rolled out before the end of the year, but that's hot news.
It's very timely too.
Very timely. And then the final one, my daughter actually found this one. It's called A Flicker of Hope, and it's by Julia Cook. And this analogy is the candle whose flame is not as bright as some of her cohorts. She finds out that, you know, we all have a flame, and sometimes when our flame is not as bright, others can lend their light to us, and it doesn't diminish their light at all. And it's really, it's a delightful book, and it shows about how we're able to impact others and can give our light to others when they're not feeling as bright or as well or as belonging. And it's the author is from the Sarah T. Butler's Children's Center at the Pastoral Institute of Columbus, Georgia. And they are dedicated to the mental health and well-being of children ages 1 to 18.
Oh, wow.
The center provides comprehensive services that span psychological testing, intervention, therapy groups, and counseling. In all our activities, we seek to inspire growth through faith, hope, and love. So that's the publisher of the book, but it's just a delightful story. And I think even though it's a children's book, it certainly has a message for all of us. Because during 2020, one of the things that has been short hope
supply,
has been in short supply. So anywhere that we can be a ray of hope, a flicker of hope for others is a very good thing.
You brought such a good range of books, I think. Everything from the physical, I guess physiological, aspect of the brain to getting to the kids' books or even anxious people, kind of the emotional aspect that is a consequence of the way your brain works, but needs to be treated in a different way. You know, like being there for other people, getting the right resources that you need, acknowledging that it's okay to struggle as an adult. It's okay to feel like you're not a real grown up because you woke up and you realized you forgot to pay your rent by one day or something.
Actually, that actually just happened to me last week. I thought I had written that I'd paid my car payment in my checkbook. And then when I was balancing my checkbook 2 weeks later, it's like, why didn't that car payment come through? I don't understand. And I had to go online. Well, that's because I didn't click to pay it. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, I've been paying bills for well more than 50 years, and boom, there it was. So happens to the best of us.
Yes, exactly. And it's important to acknowledge that so everyone can have that feeling of it's okay.
It's
okay. Completely normal.
Exactly. It is so easy to have imposter syndrome in the adult world. You feel everybody else has stuff together.
And especially because as a teenager or as a younger, a middle school student, you're looking up to these people and they're somehow buying things and driving places.
Right.
And you just assume it's because they have some secret knowledge. But then you become 18 or 21 or whatever age and you realize no one imparted that secret knowledge on you. And then you realize, wait a second, were they all just pretending this whole time? Yeah,
and the answer to that is yes. Yes. They were all just pretending.
They were just taller than you, so they seemed like adults.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I think that's all the questions I have. I don't know if you had anything you wanted to say in closing.
Sounds great. But thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah, thank
of course,
you. And
yeah,
thank you for bringing us a nice variety.
Yeah. Exactly. I love when we have a topic, but we have options for every possible reader. It's always good.
And stay tuned next week for more fantastic book recommendations.
Bye.
Bye.